Suspect Convictions is sponsored by Undisclosed. Listen at undisclosed-podcast.com.
The streetlights come on. It's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering is tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana. This week, Scott Reeder sat down with some people behind other true crime podcasts to discuss the Stanley Liggins case. He's joined by Esther Ludlow of the podcast Once Upon a Crime, Charlie Worrell of the podcast Insight, and Amelia McDonald Perry of the podcast Undisclosed.
Okay, why don't we start out with Esther? Tell us about your podcast.
Hi, so I'm Esther Ludlow, and my podcast is called Once Upon a Crime. And I tell true crime stories. I would say I'm primarily a storyteller. I tell each story as a series, and it's grouped into a type of crime. So, and each episode details one case. So, for example, right now, the series I'm on is a series on mass murders. I do a lot of historical ones, so some that may be very old, and also some newer ones. I've also covered a series about killer couples and celebrity stalkers. So I group them into a series, but each episode stands alone. And I guess the only thing I'd say beyond that is that my background in correctional psych, I kind of like the analysis of the crime and the criminal. So I do dive into some of that motivation, you know, makeup of the crime and the criminal.
Now, you're a licensed clinical counselor, is that correct?
Yeah, I am a counselor. I'm not a therapist, but I do have a master's in counseling psychology, and my emphasis was in correctional psych, so it was working with I was working with juveniles in the correctional who were in the, you know, in institutionalized, basically.
Okay. And how about you, Charlie?
I'm Charlie, and my podcast is called Insight. My co-host and I, we discuss primarily unresolved true crime, so a little bit different than Esther's. We're research-based. We like to talk about not just the elements of the crime, but we like to bring in the social and the forensic issues and dive into some of the research behind those that have to do with whatever story we're presenting that week. I'm in the U.S., as you could probably tell from my accent, but my co-host is in Australia, so we also get to talk about the differences in our legal systems and even a little bit into the differences in our culture.
Okay, well, that's cool. And Amelia, why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Sure. My name's Amelia McDonald Perry, and I am one of four hosts of the new arc of a podcast called Undisclosed, which in the past had done mostly wrongful conviction cases. But for this arc, we are reinvestigating the killing of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. So basically going back to the very beginning, really taking a deep look at what happened to him on April 12, 2015, and then also looking at what happened with the criminal charges that were brought against six Baltimore police officers in his death. It ended up working out that one trial ended in a mistrial, three others were acquitted by a judge, and then State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby dropped the charges against the rest of the officers. So we're really kind of going back and looking and trying to figure out what actually happened both to Freddie Gray, but then also with the case against the officers who were sort of tasked with his arrest, detainment, and transport.
Well, you know, I know that you all have listened to Suspect Convictions, and obviously this is a highly anticipatory time right now as we head into a trial. It'll be beginning May 22nd in Waterloo, Iowa. There's a lot of moving parts in this case, obviously, and it's got a lot of challenges because it's a 27-year-old case. So I guess the question I have for you, what's your initial impressions when you listen to the podcast?
I mean, I would say, this is Amelia, one of the things that I'm most sort of fascinated by and interested in seeing how this plays out is how you retry a case so many years after the fact. This is a particular interest to me. I've covered, for example, the Adnan Syed case, which was also covered by a previous season of Undisclosed. And that's a case where, you know, his conviction was recently overturned and he's awaiting potential for a retrial. And that will be, if that ends up happening, it'll be a good couple of decades since he was originally convicted. And so I'm really interested to see what happens in this case with, you know, the witness memories and their ability to sort of give good testimony now after so much time has passed, and how that will end up sort of working out in court as far as, you know, the eventual verdict in this case.
Okay. How about you, Esther? What comes to mind when you've listened to the case?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, she brought up Serial because I was kind of thinking back onto that case and, you know, how it compares to this case. And it feels like this one is even more complex because we have somebody who, you know, obviously has a history of, you know, bad behavior. Let's put it that way. And, you know, other, you know, convictions, other arrests, you know, a lot of that going into it. And yet we have to untangle that from this case. And is he or is he not, you know, guilty of this case? You know, looking at the evidence. And so I think it's much more, you know, complex in that way.
One of the things that, from a podcasting standpoint, that I've really enjoyed about this podcast is it's not a clear-cut wrongful conviction. It's not everyone's going to come away with a really strong opinion on it. I bet most of your listeners are probably more like me, where they're like, I don't know what happened. And I think that makes it very interesting because then we can delve into less innocence versus guilt and more about the legal side and if the case was proved by the state and those issues.
What, you know, Amelia, you and I chatted a little bit earlier. You had some concerns about some of the issues involving law enforcement. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think to Charlie's point, it's true. This case is interesting, especially to me, because he's not, you know, he's not necessarily a defendant you're really rooting for. You know, he's not like, he doesn't have the sort of maybe appeal of like an Adnan Syed did. He's a complicated guy. But I think what's more important than that is whether or not he had a fair and just prosecution, if the investigation was fair and just, and that to me seems like the real issues in this case. And that to me has that's more important to me in the sort of long run when we're talking about criminal justice issues, which is not to say that I don't, you know, the victim in this crime and what happened to her is abhorrent and horrible, and whoever is responsible should be held responsible. But they should be held responsible with the fairest sort of you know, with the law being applied fairly and with everything being done within the bounds of the law. And there are things that were done in this case that are problematic, that give me pause, and that potentially stand in the way of having a just conviction. And that's terrible, even if he is guilty, because it makes it so that a guilty verdict could still be, you know, overturned in the long run, thus drawing out this process even more. So that to me is like an issue that everybody should be concerned about beyond just whether or not he did it. But you want him to, if he did it, you want him to go to jail because they properly investigated and they properly prosecuted him.
Okay. What's your thoughts, Charlie?
I have to agree completely with Amelia on the legal aspects of this case. I think when we look at a case, and from my standpoint, especially as a mom with several children, the emotional impact on the victim in this case really starts to take over. Sometimes we have to zoom out and we have to look broader and say, if we're letting the state or the police cheat their way to a conviction of a guilty man, that just makes it more likely that they'll do that and convict an innocent man. So we have to hold the system accountable even if the person is guilty. Now, I don't know how much that's, I think a lot's going to come out in the trial about what was held back, what wasn't. But I think it's interesting that they were able to get two appeals through of two convictions. That makes me think maybe there is something here that needs to be looked into and how it was investigated and the legal aspect.
Esther, your specialty is criminal psychology. What was your reaction when we talked to various people involved in this case? But I think particularly when I went out and I was interviewing Frank Rising, he was the cellmate of Stanley Liggins. I ended up interviewing him out in the middle of a dark parking lot by myself, and it was an interesting 15-minute interview. Did you find some of the things he said kind of head-scratching?
What I've seen with, people that, prisoners that, that are incarcerated, when they're inside and when they're still part of that community, they tend to be much more, I call it telling war stories, where they want to come in and everybody wants to one-up each other and, show how tough they are and, all of the things they've done and all of the things they've seen and they... they know. And that is one thing he did do with you was he kept basically just saying, yeah, this guy's a monster. This guy's, he's guilty, he wasn't very effusive about it, but he did, mention it several times. And one of the things, too, that I see is very interesting when you talk to people that have been incarcerated, people that are incarcerated, is that they will it's funny because they're criminals, but they're very law and order. And what I mean by that is they will, peg somebody as a good guy or a bad guy, and they will, they just think these are the worst people in the world. Meanwhile, you're sharing a cell with this person, so, but they will consider themselves better than this person. At least I didn't do this. At least I don't molest children. At least I didn't murder somebody. I was attempted murder, but at least I didn't murder somebody. I mean, there's all these kind of, variations of being a good person or a bad person, and it's very blurred lines when you're in that population. But once they're out, then they don't really want to, most of the time, unless they have that criminal mindset where they're going to go right back to what they were doing, which what I saw with, with this person is he's trying to live a life on the outside now and trying to keep to that. So he doesn't want to too closely, ally himself with that or with him or a person like Stanley in any way. And that was really kind of stood out to me, where he's playing a role, he's playing the role that he needs to play in that moment, is I guess the best way that I can, describe it.
What gave me pause, going back and listening to that interview, was at one point he's talking about how Jesus helped him overcome his alcoholism and become sober. But then almost in the next breath, he's saying that he hopes that that Stanley Liggins gets, I think he used the term, butt-raped. Those don't seem, I don't claim to be the greatest theologian in the world, but I don't think Jesus would be calling for somebody to be raped either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and again, it's just that, it's like having 2 feet in 2 different worlds. You know what I mean? And on the one hand, like I said, trying to live this life outside where, he can, live like a normal citizen, and yet still kind of having that little bit of a need to show himself as a tough guy, as, you can't take advantage of me. Every question that you asked him, he was very guarded about answering, even the ones that seemed pretty innocuous. Because he wants, and I think, and I don't know if you got the sense of this, I was wanting to ask you this, is did you get the sense that he was trying to intimidate you in any way? He seemed like he might have been trying to be a scary guy with you. Did it feel like that?
He tried a little bit to be intimidating. But yeah, it was a hard one to figure out where he was coming from. I was glad that he was willing to talk to me. It took some talking on my part to get him to open up, but he did say some things that I thought were rather fascinating. when he said that he was threatened with being charged with accessory to murder, it's like, okay, if he didn't testify against Stanley Liggins, it's like, okay, why would you say that? I mean, you know, this is something that would have happened 26, 37 years ago. Why on earth would you be contending that now if, you know, I mean, what's your motivation for telling that story if it weren't true? So, I mean, any thoughts there? Did you guys think that his comments were believable or questionable? Or how about you, Charlie?
I don't find jailhouse informants terribly believable in general because they have too much of an incentive to lie. But what he's saying is pretty scaled back. It's not overblown. It's not this big, long crying confession or anything like that that would kind of start triggering, okay, maybe this isn't true. So it is kind of hard to read.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this, Esther. You know, your background is dealing with folks that are been in trouble with the law. You know, from talking to the original defense attorney involved in the Liggins case, one of the things that he said he found Frank Rising's comments very hard to believe because Stanley Liggins at the point when he would have been sharing a cell with him was had already served a number of years in prison. He knew what the rules were, even the unwritten ones, when you're incarcerated. And he said, you know, plus there's the factor, these are two people of different races. And in a prison setting that, I'm told, can be a real dividing factor. So one of the questions that comes to my mind is, why on earth would Stanley Liggins make a statement like that to, you know, a person he obviously didn't get along with?
Yeah, you know, I thought about that because I thought one of two things. Either he didn't say it, and this guy was, you know, had some kind of incentive to say that he did say it, or he did say it and he's full of crap because, you know, and it could go either way, really, because that's the thing I'm talking about. So, you know, he's in jail with this guy. You know, the guy was saying, you know, and I don't know how true this actually is, but he basically said, you know, I didn't even talk to him. I didn't interact with him. And you were asking him those questions. Well, wait a minute, you're in a cell with him for all these hours. You don't have a conversation, you know, and which I find hard to believe, but, you know, who knows? But you have to put it in the context where he says, I was watching TV and I said, that's you. And he said, yeah, but they're not going to get me for it. Now that I can totally believe somebody of that mindset saying, because he's trying to score, like, you know, cool guy points or tough guy points with a cellmate or another incarcerated person. That happens all the time where it's like, you know, I'm going to come off looking like, you know, I'm the tough guy, don't mess with me, or yeah, that's right, you know, I'm, you know, that kind of thing, where it means, in that context, means absolutely nothing. There's just a lot of that kind of, you know, crosstalk happening where people are, you know, trying to brag or trying to, you know, look tougher to the other guy. I mean, that happens all the time. So I could totally believe if he said something to that effect, just because, you know, here's this guy that basically looks at him like he's a piece of crap. And now he's going to say, yeah, that's right, that's me. So that's the part that I kind of think, well, it's possible that may have happened in that context for that reason.
Folks, let me recommend a really good podcast to you. I like it almost as much as Suspect Convictions. It's called Undisclosed. I've really gotten into it. For example, the first season, they looked at the Adnan Syed case in a more in-depth way than Serial did. And they did a terrific job. Right now, they're looking at the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore. You remember he was the young man who died mysteriously in the back of a police paddy wagon. And they're really doing some in-depth digging. And I admire that so much because I'm a longtime investigative reporter. And I know good reporting when I see it. And this is excellent reporting. I highly recommend it. Again, folks, go to undisclosed-podcast.com and download it. Again, undisclosed-podcast.com. I highly recommend it.
I got an interesting
email the other day that raised a question I hadn't crossed my mind. It's a quote that we begin each episode with, and the title sequence. Stanley Liggins says something to the effect of, "I like cheese, but I'm no rat. I like kids, but not like that." And the person asked the question, do you think he was saying that he's not a rat in a sense, I know who did this, and I'm not going to, but I'm not going to say? Does that seem like a plausible thing, or does that just seem like far-fetched fantasy? What are you thinking, Amelia?
Or he was just looking to rhyme. I mean, possibility too. But is it possible he knows who did it? I mean, he did know, you know, her mother. It's conceivable that he knew other people who might have had access and could have, you know, gotten to the victim. I suppose it is possible that he could know who did it if he didn't do it. Whether or not he was trying to be sort of very, very sly and sort of like imply that, I don't know. That would be kind of crafty of him. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's a totally plausible theory.
How about you, Charlie? What do you think?
It's an interesting theory, and kind of off of what Amelia said, I don't really know enough about him to know if he would have the sophistication to kind of encode a clue in this rhyme. It really came across to me more as just a cultural way of expressing himself, and not so much a psychopath who's not showing any empathy or emotion for the victim. I didn't really hear it that way, but I have wondered about his possible involvement as an accessory rather than as the murderer, just because, you know, the eyewitnesses seeing his car, that doesn't necessarily mean he was the only one there.
Oh, you'll remember that Mike Toby, one of Liggins' defense attorneys from the second trial, said, you know, he wonders if it may have been an issue of being an accessory rather than the actual person who committed the crime. I'm going to ask you each the same question. I mean, there's a lot of things here that we know as listeners. You know, we know that Stanley Liggins was convicted of sexually touching a 9-year-old girl in a case that happened a month before Jennifer Lewis's murder. We know that Stanley Liggins served 7 years in prison in Mississippi for armed robbery. We know that he was accused of by another inmate of trying to sexually assault him, although there were never any charges made, but we know there was that accusation in his prison file. And, of course, he was acquitted of stabbing a man in a murder case in Mississippi as well. So those are all things that the jurors will never hear. The question I have is, if you were sitting on the jury, based on what you've heard so far as the circumstantial evidence, would you vote for acquittal or would you vote for a guilt? Why don't we start out with you, Amelia?
Me first. God. But also knowing that, I mean, as a juror, do I also know that there's this, you know, suppressed evidence as well, or do I not know about
that? You don't, you know about the suppressed evidence, you know about the informant who had been on the peace payroll. Obviously, certain things will be not allowed in as evidence against Liggins. So, I mean, this is kind of the situation that they're going to be having in Waterloo when the trial begins.
Right. I mean, I guess the thing is I'd also want to know sort of, I'm going to be going based off of, you know, these same sort of witnesses retestifying, ideally, if they're still alive or they're able to. And I think you mentioned on a previous episode that anybody who isn't able to testify again, if they've passed away, they'll be reading their testimony out. Is that true?
That is correct.
Okay. God, I think because I have my doubts, I would acquit, because I just that's where I tend to go with these types of things. I'm really squicked out by the jailhouse informant and the suppressed evidence. I just am, you know, when that happens, I it makes it hard for me to have confidence in other evidence in the case, too. So,
how about you, Charlie?
I always say on Insight that if I was the only juror on a trial, I would still probably deadlock because I have such a hard time saying guilty or innocent. I mean, I wasn't there. I can't really ever get myself beyond, you know, probability. I don't have problems with circumstantial cases in general, but a circumstantial case where all the circumstances, or at least most of them, are relying on eyewitnesses who don't seem, some of them seem rather tentative. You know, I was drunk when I ID'd him. Maybe it was this car. It looked a lot like that car. You know, I kind of go back and forth on that. And then going back to probability, I have to wonder, what's the probability that Stanley would have left no forensic evidence of himself at the scene, and he left no evidence, forensic evidence, of Jennifer in his car? I really struggle not that the I struggle that there's a lack of forensic evidence in a case that involves an assault and a child in a car and a crime scene. Well, I mean, if you count his car, two crime scenes. Just completely off the cuff, I think he's guilty, but I'm not sure the case is proved.
And how about you, Esther?
A couple of questions. Will they hear about the alternate theory of the stepfather at all? Will the defense bring that in?
Of course, we don't know for sure what the defense is going to bring in. But if it's anything like the first two trials, I think that's a fairly safe bet.
Because there's, you know, I find this a lot, and I think this is why I, like Charlie, have a hard time knowing which way I'd go most of the time, because it feels like in these trials that, you know, you listen to these cases, and it's, they're trying to have it both ways. So they're trying to say that this guy is, you know, this kind of personality, you know, he's, you know, violent, and he's out of control, and he's, you know, all of those terrible things. And yet, like, you know, Charlie said, he left absolutely no forensic evidence. So is that, which is he? Is he this out of control criminal, or is he a criminal mastermind that knows how to get rid of absolutely 100% of the evidence? So you see what I'm saying? Like, you try to do those, both of those things. The other question that I've been mulling around in my head since I started listening to the podcast is when, you know, that from the beginning where you're talking about his little rhyme, what I've heard people say about that is, oh, gosh, that points to him, you know, having a guilty conscience or a guilty mind or being flip. And so that shows that he's, you know, capable of this, you know, so it's that kind of idea they have about him because of that statement he made that seemed, you know, pretty, you know, just kind of like a flip statement, like whatever. But then we talk about, you know, Joe Glenn and that whole thing where he's out in the street yelling about how he killed his daughter or stepdaughter and he'll kill them or whatever. And then we hear, you know, that comes up and they say, oh, well, you know, this guy just likes to shoot off his mouth, you know, and they just dismiss that. So it's like, okay, which is it? If somebody makes a stupid statement, is that some kind of evidence we should hold on to? Or is that just, oh, these kind of, you know, guy, he just is, you know, shooting off his mouth. So it's like having it both ways. So I think when, if I was sitting on a jury and they brought in those things, I would think that way. And I'd throw out all of that, you know, it'd be like, okay, well, you can't have both ways. So both of those things, I don't even consider. So then it would come down to, you know, what's the evidence, you know, what's the forensic evidence? Eyewitness, you know, I'm sorry, but we all know eyewitness testimony, which you talked about on the podcast as well, is so unreliable. And you're right, there's that whole CSI effect, but we want something that says, hey, here's some DNA, here's a fiber, here's a hair, here's something. And when we don't get that, I would think that would be the only thing I would have. And if you don't have that for me, then I'd have to acquit. So that's just where I would be right now, knowing what I know.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate you taking your time for me.
A big thank you again to our guests, Esther Ludlow from Once Upon a Crime, Charlie Worrell of Insight, and Amelia McDonald-Perry of the podcast Undisclosed. production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. A big thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. And thank you to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV Channel 8.